The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books podcast with me, Claire Armistead.
And me, Sian Kane.
This week, we talk to the novelist Glenn Patterson about identity and Ireland. And later in the show, we'll be asking Sam Jordison about the best books to read to lift your spirits if you're self-isolating and in need of a little joy. Glenn Patterson is a Northern Irish writer who made his debut in 1988 with Burning Your Own, a coming-of-age tale set at the start of Northern Ireland's troubles in 1969. It won a Betty Trask Award and the Rooney Prize for Irish Literature. He currently teaches creative writing at Queen's University, Belfast. His most recent novel, Where Are We Now, focuses on Herbie, a bewildered divorcee trying to make a new life in a rapidly renewing Belfast where the ghosts of the past remain unquiet. When he came into the studio to talk to our colleague Lindsay Irvine, Glenn began by reading a passage introducing us to Herbie.
Somebody had stolen his identity. An elaborate, thoroughgoing fraud stretching back years, decades. The evidence had all been laid out on the table before him, staggering in its scope and audacity. Passports in two nationalities, staff cards, union cards, mortgage statements, loan applications, a marriage certificate, flawlessly executed, photographs, lots and lots of photographs, starting on the steps of the wedding church with their sprinkling of confetti, running on then through reception and honeymoon, Paris by the looks of it, to holidays by the sea, Christmas trees, works dinners, charity discos, fun runs, hill walks, at least five identically posed with this character leaning his arm on the roofs of new cars, Fiesta, Allegro, Renault 12, 21, Citroen C5, the receipts for which were in a separate envelope in a different box, along with the cooker receipts, the fridge receipts, the serial television and television recording device receipts, Betamax to Blu-ray. It would have taken a lifetime near to go through it in detail. And at the end of it all, he told his doctor, for despite all that evidence, he had a hunch this was still more a medical than a legal matter. He would have looked up and said, hand on heart, I have no idea who this person is, but it's not me. The doctor leaned back in her seat, fingers laced on her stomach. She was on the home straight now to retirement. She had wisdom to dispense. Don't take this the wrong way, Herbie, she said, but half the people in this country probably wish they had your problem. He kneaded his temples with thumb and ring finger. Some days it felt as though he was carrying a concrete block around in there. Some days an empty box. Do you think I need a prescription? Yes. Don't sit up late at night looking at old photos.
Thank you for the reading.
And yeah, Herbie's changed in ways he has not yet fully woken up to, which seems to be a pretty general condition for all time, but it also seems particularly piquant in Northern Ireland.
It, you know, given the other things that have been going on in the public realm, there have been, some interesting changes changes in definition or threats of changes, or depending on which way you look at it, promises of changes of definition about what Northern Ireland is and where Northern Ireland is, where it sits in the relationships within these islands and where it relates to the rest of Europe. So that was something that was in my mind as well as I started to write it. But Herbie is somebody who I think all of us at various moments in our lives are propelled out of or gracefully allowed to step out of some of the roles that we've maybe occupied unthinkingly for quite a number of years. Things that maybe defined us: parent, partner, spouse, employee. And all of those things have changed fairly in quite short order for Herbie. He's he's experienced rather a lot of change. He's not entirely unhappy with his lot. He's trying to get used to the changes in his own life, but also the changes in the city of Belfast, which is changing rapidly all around him. Again, he's trying to work out if he's still living in the same city without having moved away.
Yes, the novel pays a lot of attention to the fact that everywhere you turn, it's a different kind of iteration of the city, and the docklands have been rebuilt, and there's the...
Oh God, you have to redo your docklands. We realised everybody else had redone theirs, so of course we had to do ours as well. At the time that I was starting to write the novel, we were in a peak hotel building phase in Belfast. In not so long ago, we had, I think, maybe we had two or three hotels. We certainly didn't have that many. And now there's been such a growth in hotel building. So all around him, he's seeing this change. As indeed I have to say, I would notice quite a lot of change. I think probably a lot of people will have experienced this. There's a time in your life where you feel you're right across the city. There's not a bit of it that you don't know. And then there are other moments where you look and you see something in the far distance being built, and you think maybe that's the city I'm never going to live in. That's the city that's going to be after me.
That's a sobering thought. But there's also at a more local level, things are changing in a way that's common or very familiar in England as well, is that the sort of late capitalist structures of the post office is on the way out.
The post office is on the way out. Well, the post office is moving into a filling station. But yes, the little neighbourhood that he lives in with its shops, gradually they're all closing. Charity shops and cafes are the only things that are opening. And there's an expanding church. There are churches now that are self-sustaining communities that have their preferred doctors, accountants, estate agents even. So Herbie and some of his friends in this neighbourhood are kind of keeping a watchful and wary eye on the creep. I think that's the right word I want to use there. The creep of this particular church.
Well, it's a very new variety of Protestantism.
I think probably Paisley was such a large figure, a larger than life figure, and larger than all the other sects put together figure, that perhaps he obscured the reality of Protestantism in Northern Ireland. It comes in a great many varieties, this new relaxed version of Protestantism is on the up.
Yes, but the sort of relaxation around the areas of sexuality, for
absolutely,
instance, that seems quite novel.
Well, you know, I mean, a lot has changed in recent times in Northern Ireland, and I'm delighted to say that thanks to Brexit, and in a kind of a curious way, Brexit and the DUP's influence over the government actually got us equal marriage finally, because they annoyed everybody so much in the Conservative Party and in the opposition that last summer, to spite them, I think we finally had Westminster forcing through legislation on equal marriage, which we've been campaigning for years there. So it's delightful to see that.
Yes. And another change is the rising numbers of tourists.
We're a very popular tourist destination, and quite a lot of them are coming to what used to be the shipyard and is now Queen's Island, the shipyard, and is now the Titanic Quarter with the Titanic Visitor Centre. And we also have the Titanic Film Studios down there, where Game of Thrones has been most famously has been filmed. And so a lot of that new influx of people are gravitating to the place where Herbie finds himself working part time as a freelance researcher in the records office.
Yes,
people coming looking for their ancestry.
Yes, which as the novel shows, people, that sort of family history seems a rather benign strand of history, but the novel goes on to reflect on the fact that things haven't changed that much.
No, I mean, people have a desire, actually, it used to be in times past that you wanted your family tree to be quite neat and to fit into a frame, and you would cut off anything that was awkward in the family tree, but now people want they want interesting and colourful families and histories, and so there are a lot of people, particularly Americans in the novel, who are coming looking for their connections with the troubled past.
The Bermuda Shorts Triangle.
The Bermuda Shorts Triangle, I do. Yes, that's right. Down around the Titanic signature building, which I have to say, actually, it's a very nice part of the town. I do quite like the part of town, but yeah, there are. It is a bit of a trap for tourists. And all of this is happening at the same time as some of the things that events of the more recent past haven't entirely been put to rest. There is still one of the things that tourists come for is to have photographs taken in front of some of our wall murals, paramilitary wall murals. And in the part of Belfast that I live in the east of the city, some of those are still very aggressive, still in the hooded gunmen. And you would have people standing, busloads of people coming and getting out and having their photographs taken, standing next to these. And yet these same organisations are active. I mean, these aren't harking back to a distant past. These are still, you know, in the UVF, in the UDA, and in various forms of the IRA, they are still beating people up. They're still murdering people. So this is very much it might be a tourist attraction. But for people who live there, this is still something that's a real problem.
There's not much kind of glamorous excitement there, if you look closely enough. And also, I mean, for the most part, the novel Sectarian Madness seems a very long way away. But it's set in East Belfast, and this is another thing that hasn't changed. It's still the demographic is still very much divided. In the city, isn't it?
The city is still a divided place. I think one of the things about Belfast is that it probably, at one and the same time, it is more divided simply in terms of the number of peace walls that we have. There are actually far more of them than there were back in 1998 when the Good Friday Agreement was signed. And yet it was always the case that it was a more possible city, if I can call it that, than perhaps would have been apparent on the surface. It was the east of the city is considered to be almost exclusively Protestant, unionist, and it's certainly not. So it's changing. Things are always in motion there, as they are in all cities. It might take a little bit of a time before we actually see what the next stage of Belfast's development is going to be. But there is change around the edges.
Yes, and as we've seen from reproductive rights, things can actually change very quickly, when they
absolutely. Things can change, and curiously, I wrote a book between finishing this novel and it coming out. I wrote a non-fiction book called Backstop Land, which I began last May and came out at the end of October, 31st of October. It was the only thing that came out on the 31st of October. I suggested to Head of Zeus, the publishers, that we should have a campaign that says, "We're out, why aren't you?" But I wrote that book, and it was partly a kind of an overview of Northern Ireland and how the Brexit debates and negotiations were affecting Northern Ireland. But it was also a diary of the time that I was writing it. So it's a diary of last summer. And you know, it did seem at one stage in the middle of, say, June of last year that we didn't have the Stormont government having been sitting at that stage for 2.5 years. We were still at that stage agitating for equal marriage, abortion reform, the only place on the islands that hadn't had those. So it did seem at that stage as though nothing was going to move. And then very quickly, within a very short period of time, we've got Stormont back up and running. We have equal marriage and we have the abortion reform coming as well. So things can change very, very quickly. The one thing I caution against is the tendency to think that everything's fixed that's it. It's all good. It's all better. We don't have to think about it anymore. And the persistence of paramilitary organizations, the blight on young lives of things like punishment attacks, which all the paramilitary organizations indulge in, and the victims are nearly always, as indeed is the case in Where Are We Now, one of the characters falls victim to this. They're nearly always young males are the people who fall foul of them.
Yes, and they linger around like the malign seagulls.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, hover around the story. But this is a long way from being a book about the troubles, but it's the ghosts of that era are an insistent presence in and have been throughout your career in fiction. I wonder, do you ever resent that subject being more or less unavoidable?
I never thought of the troubles as being a subject. I think of, Belfast is my city. Most of my novels are set in Belfast. Was one that was set in Hiroshima. There was one that was set in Euro Disney. But apart from that, I have tended to set novels in Belfast, probably split equally between those set in the present of their writing and those that are set in the recent past, except for one that was set in the 1830s. That is my city, and it feels like the natural place for me to set fiction. And I grew up reading fiction set in Chicago, New York, London, Manchester, St. Petersburg. I'd never been to any of those places, but I took it just on trust that the place that the writers were writing about, the places that they were writing about, were real. And I always thought that I wanted to write about Belfast in that way. I didn't want to have glossary of terms. I didn't want to have little maps at the beginning showing people where they were. I thought, just come to the city through the pages of the book. And so the city that I have lived in most of my life and that I've set most of my fiction in is a city that has had, for a period of a few decades, the main news story from it has tended to be this conflict. I had a novel called Number 5, which was the number of a house in a housing development in Belfast, and I started it in the 1950s, and it ran on to the early 2000s when I published it in 2003. And my thought with that was that the house was actually older than the troubles. So in the 1950s, that isn't the main news story, and by the time the novel ends, it's post-Good Friday Agreement. And I wanted to do that to say precisely that the troubles wasn't the only story. It was something that was a part of life. Anybody who lived there had to deal with what that brought, the complications of the very simple thing, of going out in the evening, trying to meet people. Was kind of occasionally very difficult, all those kind of complications, to say nothing of the enormities of the loss of life, just how you go about the ordinary business of living, or maybe the extraordinary business of living, of falling in love and making a life.
People manage that sort of moving around the great sort of political obstacles.
My heroes are people of my parents' generation who decided to stay there. A lot of people very reasonably left. Some people couldn't leave, but other people decided to invest their lives in that city in a time that was very, very difficult. And I think, there's a lot of people, the city that it has become and is becoming owes a great debt to the people who just, insisted on still going out to a dinner dance, still going out for a drink on a Friday night, still going into town on a Saturday afternoon. I mean, those are all real investments in a place that I just think, can't be underestimated.
Yes. But as Herbie, of course, and his daughter, the question of getting out is hovering around.
Herbie's daughter, Beth, one of the I suppose at the very beginning of the novel, Herbie is just about reconciled to the end of his marriage. It's been over for a few years. He's moved into another house. He's living on his own. He's lost his job. But things are just about settling down. And then he gets a text from his daughter to say that she's on her way back from England. And it turns out she's coming home because she's bankrupt. So she's coming back to stay with him for a little while. That turns into quite a long while. So that's the bulk of the novel is really the relationship between Herbie and his daughter, or the other relationships that Herbie has while Beth is back living with him. She couldn't get out fast enough when she was 18. As soon as she got her exam results, she was away, and hasn't really been back in the decade since, until this bankruptcy.
To finish, I can't resist asking about the political future of a country. Any given country is always going to be preposterous, but I can't resist asking you, where are you now?
Where are we? Where are we now? Well, we're somewhere slightly different in early 2020 than we were in the autumn of 2019, just simply because of the change in the withdrawal agreement and the what people are referring to as the border in the Irish Sea. So instead of the backstop and the concern around a hard border between north and south, we now have this somewhat tricky thing to negotiate or even understand, which is the potential for a customs arrangement between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. I always think that whatever has been has not lasted. No political arrangement in the history of humankind has lasted for more than a few centuries. And anything that has been has not lasted, and anything that has been could be again. So, if you're asking me in the short term what's going to happen, no idea. If you're asking me in the long term, the islands will drift together and they'll drift apart. Come back in 5 million years. Yeah. see where we are then.
That was Glenn Patterson. Where Are We Now is published by Apollo. After the break, we'll be talking to Sam Jordison and getting his top books to read if you want to clear your mind of coronavirus. Welcome back to the Guardian Books Podcast. Coronavirus is the headline of the day, with reports coming in thick and fast from every corner of the world. So, what to do if you're self-isolating and have already binged on your favourite shows? Read a book, of course, and we have just the man to help you decide which to choose. On the line with us now is Sam Jordison, co-founder of Galley Beggar Press and the man behind The Guardian's reading group and Tips, Links and Suggestions blog. Hi, Sam. You're coming to us from Norwich, which is not part of the London cluster. Is there a cluster of trouble around you, or is it all very calm?
Hi there. Well, I'm sure there probably is trouble on the way. It feels calm at the moment. Of course, there's a worry it's the calm before the storm. And I'm not going very far from the house, so I don't know what it's like in the city centre. But things... there's this strange feeling that the roads are quieter, but there are more people walking around. And I suppose the thing I noticed the most, actually, is everyone's looking slightly nervous and we're all trying to keep our distance from each other.
Yeah, and I got the tube on the way here, and it was quite a strange seeing everyone trying to have a seat between. Normally you have to fight for seats, and everyone was like refusing to sit down if there wasn't two seats there. But Sam, we run the reading group on the Guardian Books website, and it's free for anyone to join. So if you're interested at all, if you're at home and you're bored and you want to join in a chat, we're reading Make Room, Make Room by Harry Harrison, which has turned out to be a very timely book, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. It's been really timely. So the book is set in New York in 1999. And the general idea is that there's been huge overpopulation problems. There are food shortages, and it's about the dystopian, what was the future, because it was written in 1966. And it's been really, what can I say, it's been fascinating. In a way, I've been comparing and contrasting the problems we have in the real world right now and the problems in the book, which is slightly macabre in some ways, but also it's strangely validating and gives you hope. You know, the people in the book, they can get through it. So hopefully we can too, is the one of the main things I've taken from it.
So it raises two things. One is about dystopias. Do we actually want to read dystopias when we're living in through dystopian times? Or do we want to read for comfort?
I think my feeling is a bit of both. I can't really give you I'm sorry to hedge my bets, but I feel like it's been quite cathartic. It's given me a different perspective on what's happening to us now. And there is one of the strange things I always feel about dystopian fiction is that it's quite escapist in a way, because it presents a different reality. So stepping into that has been quite immersive and diverting and enjoyable. But there is also quite a big part of me that wants comforting books as well. I've been reading Charles Dickens.
Oh, that's the nostalgia card, which I was going to come to, because this is obviously a classic of its sort. There is a sense that one wants to return to things that one has loved in the past,
yes.
When one was possibly feeling happy and young and springy.
So I'm reading Wolf Hall again at the moment, just because of that exact reason.
You're taking
it's good.
The big run-up. I have to say, one of the books that I keep on wanting to go back to is John Wyndham's Day of the Triffids, which is, which actually combines both nostalgia and dystopia. you mentioned Wolf Hall, Sian, and that's a really big read, isn't it? Is this a time for big reads, do you think?
I think for some people it will be. I think some people will have a natural urge to want to use their time in a useful way if they can't, say, do the things they would normally do. And so some people will see this as an opportunity to tackle some of those reading, what you'd say, maybe challenges. And Yi Yun Lee actually is doing the Chinese author, she's doing a online book club at the moment where they're reading Tolstoy together.
Oh, I was going to say, but it's the War and Peace moment,
yeah,
isn't it,
exactly.
That everybody always talks about and never gets around
to. Yeah, so everyone, if you want to follow her online on Twitter, she's reading it, and a whole bunch of authors are taking part. Garth Greenwell's taking part and stuff. So it, that's kind of nice to see. I think a few people are doing that, but I also feel like some people are maybe just trying to use this time to catch up on some reading, and perhaps a way to do that is to ease into things that are comforting and maybe they have read before, but it's reassuring to know that it's good, and it maybe, like you said before, will remind them of a happier time. I think I might go back and read all of Austen. I haven't read Austen for probably about 10 years.
Jane Austen?
Yeah.
Ah.
And I was like, I really want to read Persuasion just because I know it's romantic and I kind of just want to be cheered up. I think it's a good thing for everyone to remember that. I mean, there's all these hilarious things being shared, going, oh, Shakespeare wrote King Lear during the plague. Like, why don't you use this time to be useful? And I think people should maybe not put too much pressure on themselves.
Sam, what have the tips, links and suggestions community been coming up with? Because they're very lively, aren't they? I just went, I took a brief look through last week's strand, because this week's one has only just gone up, and there were sort of like 1500 suggestions. If anybody feels the need for conversation, that is the place to head.
Absolutely.
What have they been suggesting?
They've been suggesting all sorts, as they always do. One thing that keeps popping up actually is A Journal of the Plague Year by Daniel Defoe, which seems, you know, the connections are pretty obvious. It's been lovely for me to look through and check in on, you know, lots of people who I'm familiar with, and I know their backgrounds from what they've been posting for a long time, but lots of new people coming along as well and sharing and being welcomed. And it does feel like a really good place to discuss books and be diverted, but also people are talking about things that are worrying them. They're telling us what it's like in their various parts of the world, which is fascinating. And it does feel like a really good support network at the moment.
What should you do if your concentration span is suffering? And that's something that I've felt very fidgety, and I find it just quite hard to focus on something in a sustained way, because I keep being dragged back to the Guardian Live blog with all the sort of latest announcements. I mean, do you think that actually there's a particular place for example for short stories?
I haven't personally been reading that many short stories, but I certainly know the feeling of looking on the live blog. In fact, that was one of the the funny things about reading Harry Harrison's Make Room, Make Room, I'd be reading a few pages, look on the live blog, and it would kind of all meld in my mind, the various dystopian happenings. I'm actually quite relaxed, though, about being diverted. This is one of the lovely things about reading Charles Dickens again, and a book I'm quite familiar with, is, you know, I can read a few pages, find myself drifting, and then come back to it. And I think that's okay, and I think maybe that's the way we'll have to read for a while.
He did write in installments, didn't he? So in a way, he's exactly the right sort of writer to be reading, even though it's long in the totality of the novels.
Do you know what? That's really true. And something I've been noticing, I've got a nice Penguin edition that actually tells you when the different installments, when you get to the end of an installment, there's a little note that lets you know. And that gives you a real sense of achievement. And you think, well, you know, Dickens's readers will have to wait for a week now. So that's okay, I'm getting through things.
So what about you, Sian?
Well, I mean, I do love a lot of short story writers, particularly George Saunders, who would probably be a very nice author to read now, in that he does write very bleak stuff, actually, quite a lot of the time. But he also writes about kindness a lot, and he's really interested in the ideas of in humanity, and the idea that perhaps at the heart of it most of us are essentially good, and that can be quite a nice, I find reading him quite a nice and warm experience a lot of the time. But then there's also, you know, if we're, you know, talking about dystopia and how actually that can sometimes be quite bracing, having writers who are quite gloomy, like Shirley Jackson, who I love, and I love her short stories. Actually, like, thinking about them now I want to read those. And Flannery O'Connor as well, you know. I think it's just the sense that something is contained. It's like what Sam was saying about a sense of achievement when you finish something. Something like Flannery O'Connor and Shirley Jackson, you can have that constantly, because you can just finish an 8-page short story and then go back to worrying about the life blog.
I've actually just read a really nice little Canadian short story collection called Half Sisters and Other Stories by a writer called Ryan Turner, who I hadn't heard of. It's not available in the UK, but if you're lucky enough to live in Canada, it's out from Gaspereau Press. And it's great because it spans from Soviet Russia to modern day Canada.
Oh, wow.
Really lovely, humane, gentle stories. Very, very perceptive. And the other one I've read, because I am into short stuff at the moment, is all about Sarah by this new French star, Pauline Delaboye-Allard.
Is it very saucy?
It's mad and headlong in its first half, and then the second half is all is the reckoning with the mad headlongness, which is by then finished.
Wow, okay.
And it's short and very, very intense. And I find very short, very intense things are working for me at the moment.
Mm.
I want to reread The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, and it struck me it would be a fantastic thing to read with a young child, a sort of 10, 11-year-old who's out of school. We're all going to have to be amusing kids in the next few months. And you've got an 11-year-old daughter, haven't you, Sam?
I have, and she's been off school for a week. I'm very lucky in that she still lets me read to her do nighttime reading, essentially. But we've gone onto kind of quite, you know, we're starting to break into the classics. So we're actually reading Dracula at the moment, which is fantastic for all sorts of reasons, but one of them, of course, which I'm very aware of now, is that Dracula is actually all about disease and viruses being passed on. I mean, it wasn't expressed in exactly those ways, but of course, you know, vampires, you can think of them as a metaphor for illness. You know, it's a way of understanding what's happening around us. It's also, of course, just a brilliant diverting story, and as long as you don't take Dracula's side, it has a I know we're heading towards a happy ending, which is quite reassuring at the moment.
A 19th century book that I remember reading with my daughter when she was 13, about 13, was Jane Eyre, and it was just at the point of moving from sort of kids literature to adult literature, and she at that time probably wasn't quite old enough to do it by herself, but what, you know, so we read the first half and then couldn't stop it.
I mean, that's one of those things I think that that can be a really lovely way of bridging that gap between children's literature and adult literature, because most people will end up flitting between the two their whole lives. But there are certain classics, and for me it was Catcher in the Rye, that it's accessible enough that it sort of gives you permission to then go hunt for those books that you have perhaps always thought were more challenging than they perhaps are, books that perhaps have reputations that precede them, so you think, oh, I can't do Dickens, and then you do try Dickens and you realise, oh, actually no, this is wonderful, and that's why it has the reputation. So Sam, like, what are you reading at the moment apart from Dickens, and obviously going over Make Room on the reading group, have you got any books that you're eyeing up now to with some spare time at home?
Yeah, well, I keep looking at the Terry Pratchett pile. I recently reread Night Watch, which of course was just wonderful, and it's got everything you want. It's really diverting, it reinforces your faith in humanity, and I think one of Terry Pratchett's, especially in the, if you're familiar with the Night Watch books, which are books about as the title explained, the guards who look after things at night in Ankh-Morpork, his fantasy city. There's this great character called Sam Vimes, who is the head of the Night Watch, who Terry Pratchett, he's such a good storyteller, he makes you fall completely in love with him. And Vimes' big philosophy is not to get everything right and not to be perfect, but just to do the least harm possible, which feels at the moment like a really useful motto.
The least harm possible, Dan. We'll try. Should we try? Yeah. That means not sitting too close to me at the office. We got told off. We just got monumentally told off for sitting within 3 feet of each other. Thanks very much, Sam. We'll let you get back to your Gothic reading.
Thank you very much.
I really would recommend, if you are looking for maybe some guided reading, or you want some recommendations, to join both the reading group on the website and also the tips, links and suggestions blog. All you have to do is have a Guardian comment account. We choose a new book on the first Tuesday of every month. We are still going through Make Room, but we will be doing a vote for next month's book soon. So do join in, and also on tips, links and suggestions. Just go and have a look at the comments and have a read at the conversations. It's all wonderful and diverting at the moment, I think.
And it goes up on a Monday, and you can see the threads developing through the week.
Yeah. We're already on 1,000 comments for this week, so I think everyone's kind of raring for some booky conversation.
And that's all for this week. Next week, we'll be returning to the 16th century with Toby Ferris, who'll tell us about his pursuit of the Dutch master Pieter Bruegel. If you have any thoughts about this week's episode, get in touch on Twitter at Guardian Books or on the podcast page. And you can always subscribe and review us wherever you get your podcasts from. But for now, from me, Claire Armistead.
And me, Sian Kane.
And our producer, Esther Pokujeni. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.